We're exploring three decades of federally sponsored human experimentation, the hepatitis studies in mid-century America on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Their mission was to understand viruses causing hepatitis and develop vaccines to put an end to this highly contagious liver infection that can progress into cirrhosis, can progress into liver cancer. Researchers had enrolled thousands of people in their experiments, and not just anyone. They stood up research sites in prisons and institutions for children with cognitive disabilities, often enrolling society's most vulnerable and stigmatized people. Can high-risk experiments on people really serve the greater good? When you've given consent to be part of a medical study, what did the fine print say? What did you experience? It's 800-642-1234. Sydney Halpern is a lecturer of medical education at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. Her new book is called Dangerous Medicine, The Story Behind Human Experiments with Hepatitis. Sydney, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, the medical profession has, as you know, long-standing issues with trust among patients, a huge issue with trust. Why is it important to examine this piece of history? Because there is, underneath it all, this mistrust in medicine.
Yes, indeed there is. Well, I think that the public needs to be aware, and the profession needs to be aware of mistakes that happened in the past and transparent going forward. So I think in order to understand how events like this happen, we really need to dig deeply into the various forces that have made them unroll. And that's what I'm hoping to do. It's certainly not my intention to increase distrust of science or in mistrust of vaccines. And I want to make it very clear that the risks involved in these experiments were risks having to do with an infectious disease, not risks having to do with a vaccine. Mm-hmm. So make that very, very clear.
Very important distinction. And, you know, you dug very deeply into the hepatitis studies from the early 40s until its sunset in the early 70s. Can you first step back and tell us about hepatitis itself? Because you called it a nasty illness. What is it and what damage can it do?
So hepatitis is a condition characterized by inflammation of the liver. And the symptoms it can cause are nausea, abdominal pain, exhaustion, feeling completely enervated. And also one of the signs of the condition is jaundice, which is the yellowing of the eyes and skin. Most people who experience this condition have been infected by one or several strains of viruses. Although you can get hepatitis from a non-viral cause. It's a nasty illness because it can last a very long time. It can recur. And there also can be long-term consequences. So there are a variety of strains. Hepatitis A, B, and C are the most common. With hepatitis B and C, those are viruses that are contracted from bodily fluids, most commonly blood. And for those two viruses, some proportion of people become long-term carriers. That means their bodies don't fully expel the viruses. And for carriers, over a period of some 2 decades or 3 decades, they can develop cirrhosis and liver cancer. So people who become carriers are at 25% risk of dying prematurely of these very serious long-term liver diseases.
I was just going to mention, too, hepatitis very much with us today. Millions of people have some form of hepatitis.
Indeed. And around the world, even more people have it. It's even more common outside the U.S. Recently, in 2011, researchers were able to develop one and then several cures for carriers of hepatitis C. However, there's no cure for carriers of hepatitis B, And while there's a vaccine now for hepatitis B, there's no vaccine for hepatitis C. So 75 years after researchers began serious efforts at laboratory and human research, there are still very, very big gaps in the ability to treat people with this illness.
We're talking with Sydney Halpern, who's at the intersection of moral issues and the history of human experimentation with hepatitis. Her new book is called Dangerous Medicine. You can join in. Have you participated in a medical research study? What was that experience like? Would you be willing to be infected with a virus to be able to make advancements for future generations? Join in, 800-642-1234. Let's dive into the history beginning in the 40s. Scientists, you call them the biomedical elite, they start infecting thousands of people with hepatitis. Who were these people?
Well, research in this 30-year program, there were three large categories of human subjects. Conscientious objectors to the military draft, that was during World War II. Prison inmates, mental patients, and residents in facilities for people with developmental disabilities. About 45% of the total, and I estimated 3,700 people, more than 3,700 people, about 45% were inmates in about 15 or 16 different prisons and reformatories across the United States.
Why were these scientists going after these types of people for their study?
Well, you know, it wasn't easy to get human subjects for this kind of research. And I guess you might consider these populations of convenience. When the researchers sought access, they actually had quite different arguments for the different groups of human subjects. You know, they had to get the people who manage the institutions that house these potential human subjects, they had to get them on board. And so they made different kinds of arguments. The conscientious objectors were the most consistent with what we would consider voluntary consent. They actually knew what was going on. They willingly participated, and this was about 200 men who were in a system called civilian public service, and that was a system of camps that was created during World War II for conscientious objectors who wanted to do alternative service to the draft. And there were about 12,000 men in this CPS system, and as one of the options for alternative service, the selective service, which oversaw the camps along with the peace churches who funded the camps, offered the option of participating in government-sponsored research. Hmm. And these men, I interviewed two of them. They were men in their 90s, and in their 20s, they had participated in hepatitis experiments. And they told me that they really wanted to contribute to the common good. And they also wanted to show that they weren't yellow bellies, because they were called, you know, they were called yellow bellies for not allowing themselves to be combat soldiers. And but some of them thought, well, I want to show I'm willing to die for the country, even though I'm not willing to kill for it.
And so you had said too, that these conscientious objectors, that their enrollment would really help win over the public favor for these hepatitis experiments on people. What did you see there, and did that happen?
Yes. One of the things the researchers spent a lot of time doing was generating public support for these kinds of experiments. In the beginning, all of them were funded by a unit within the military, the Army Epidemiology Board, later called the Armed Forces Epidemiology Board after World War II. And scientists were funded by this agency. And the agency and also the scientists put a lot of effort first they tried to hide the experiments, and that didn't work very well. Mm-hmm. Because the press really started finding out about them. And then the researchers developed narratives about how the research was was helping the country that's solving the problem of hepatitis with soldiers. And it was really a problem during World War II, that there were hepatitis outbreaks in the military. And conscientious objectors were very willing to talk to the press about that they knew that they were getting a terrible disease, that they were doing it for the public good, and they felt this was a contribution to science and country. So these narratives from the human subjects really helped researchers create public acceptance for these kinds of experiments. Now, that wasn't the case for people who were mental patients or in institutions for the developmentally disabled. For those, researchers really tried to keep those out of public sight for a very long time until they were not able to do so.
Keeping them under wraps. Historical sociologist Sydney Helpern studies 20th century American medical institutions and biomedical ethics. New book, Dangerous Medicine. What safeguards do you want the government to put up when researching communicable diseases or vaccines or medicine? Do you manage clinical trials now? What do you think people should know about how this research is done and what safety measures are in place? Are there limits to the risks to which human research subjects should be exposed? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're learning about America's grim and appalling hepatitis infection program spanning 30 years, mid-century, on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Historical sociologist Sydney Helpern poses this question in her book, Dangerous Medicine. Should risky studies with healthy participants proceed when the science underlying them is rudimentary at best or has long been stalled? She estimates that researchers transmitted bloodborne hepatitis to well over 1,000 people during the hepatitis studies and more than 150 children. Fast forward to today, Health and Human Services Department says millions of Americans from all walks of life live with viral hepatitis. Are you? What do you think about scientists who experimented on humans in search of a hepatitis vaccine? 800-642-1234. Author Sydney Helpern is with us for the hour. So you got to speak one-on-one with Warren Sawyer, one of the people who participated in a hepatitis study in the early 40s. Can you tell us about Warren and what you learned?
Yeah, it was a real pleasure to talk to the two men in their 90s who were conscientious objectors who had participated 70 years earlier during World War II in the experiments. So Sawyer grew up in New York City. His parents got divorced when he was in primary school. He was brought up Catholic, but he was unhappy at home as an adolescent, and he decided to go live with an aunt who was in upstate New York, and she attended a Quaker house, meeting house. And Warren got familiar with Quaker ideas, and as he said it, I liked it a lot. And he became a Quaker. And, you know, when World War II broke out, and actually even before, he got his draft notice and he decided he wanted to be a conscientious objector, even though two of his brothers were in the army. One was a Marine. And he was one of the men at, he was doing alternative service as a hospital aide at a mental hospital in Northern Philadelphia called Byberry. And that was where one of the major hepatitis researchers started recruiting conscientious objectors for hepatitis research going on at the University of Pennsylvania. Again, this was funded by the Army Epidemiology Board. And Warren and nine other men would take a bus from the hospital where they were working down to the University of Pennsylvania, where they participated in these medical procedures, in which they background blood tests were taken, and then they were actually given in various ways exposure to hepatitis viruses. Warren, he was telling me about the equipment they used to take blood, and they were really kind of scary needles, and he got very, very shy of needles, so he didn't participate for very long. But he said, you know, I did it for humanity. They told me that this could be fatal. And I asked him twice, they told you that you could die. Oh yeah, but I wasn't worried about that. The doctors were there to take care of me if I got really sick. I wanted to help humanity. I did it to help cure a really bad disease. And he said that 70 years later.
And there was no compensation involved for research injuries that might occur, you know, the disease that could come about. And there was a lot of tension around that, that there wasn't any like life insurance or disability insurance, that that after these experiments were over, these people were on their own.
Indeed they were. Indeed they were. And that's one of the things I argued at the end of the book that really needs to be changed. We don't in the United States have a system for compensating people who were asked to contribute to medical in medical experiments by serving as human subjects in experiments where they can expect no benefit. So this isn't a clinical trial where your chemotherapy didn't work and they're trying a new kind. So I would call that potentially therapeutic experiment when you can hope for medical benefit. These were non-therapeutic. The people were asked to contribute for science for future patients in the hope of getting a prevention and better treatment. So we don't have a system in the United States for compensating people who are injured, nor do we track them in the long term. And I feel very strongly that this is something that we need in this country. Warren and his compatriots were lucky. They were very healthy young men. So they were likely to be able to fully clear the hepatitis B viruses. And Warren didn't have long-term medical consequences. I actually looked for people who did, but one of my consultants who was a virologist told me, you know, they're not going to be around now because if they were carriers, they probably would no longer be alive. Mm. So, yeah.
We're talking with Northwestern University lecturer of medical education, Sydney Halpern. The new book is Dangerous Medicine. You can join in 800-642-1234. This is, and I'm just going to, fair warning here, this is a little, this is going to, might be gross to some people or just really off-putting, disturbing. How were people in studies infected with hepatitis?
Well, it turns out that, so one of the things researchers were trying to do is differentiate the different strains. It turns out that hepatitis A is what's called fecal oral. So people get it from contaminated food or water. And hepatitis B and C are fluid borne. And the most common way of getting hepatitis B and C is through blood, particularly blood transfusions. And this is these modes of transmission were something that the researchers were trying to figure out. But what they did was they took samples from people who either they knew had hepatitis or they thought had hepatitis, and they in various ways infected them or used them to infect human subjects. So for hepatitis A, when it was clear it was fecal oral, what they did was they took stool samples and mixed it with what they called chocolate milk and called it milkshakes. And mm-hmm. there was a lot of nervous commentary about this among groups of human subjects. With hepatitis B and C, although they didn't understand that C existed until after the experiments ended, although some people were exposed to C inadvertently, they mostly did injections of serum, which is the liquid portion of blood. They also tried other things, nasal washings, tissue that was taken from biopsies of people who had been biopsied, liver biopsies from having bouts with jaundice. So they tried a lot of things, but eventually they used the milkshakes and the injections of serum as the major ways that they transmitted.
In these injections, there were also challenge inoculations. Can you explain what these challenge injections were?
Yeah, the word has meant different things over time. But
yes.
Basically, let's say one of the things they were trying to do was figure out if they could create what's called passive immunity by giving people what's called gamma globulins. So this is a extract of people's serum who have been exposed to various diseases. So, and it could be used during epidemics to tamp down the number of new cases. So they'd give people gamma globulin, and then to see if it was still working, they'd expose them to the virus. Or if they were trying to, for example, see if a potential vaccine would work, they would give the vaccine or the experimental vaccine to a group they call the experimental group. And then they take a bunch of people who they call the control group who did not get the potential protective inoculation. And then they'd expose both groups to the unmodified virus. So in that situation, you would expect many people in the control group to get sick, and you would hope that not many people in the experimental group would get sick. They did these kinds of experiments with experimental and control groups throughout the 30 years.
We're going to pause right there with sociologist Sydney Halpern. We'll be back after a news update on the Ideas Network. We're discussing America's hepatitis program that spanned 30 years from the early 40s to the 1970s and what lessons we can take away now in a raging pandemic where vaccine makers and the federal government continue fighting the coronavirus that causes COVID. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Historical sociologist Sydney Halpern estimates researchers enrolled more than 3,700 people in their hepatitis infection experiments, including hundreds of children. They were told they were developing measures to control a disease that scientists described as a worldwide menace. Have you done research on hepatitis, this viral liver disease that can lead to cancer years after infection? What is the legacy of the human experiments on hepatitis? 800-642-1234. Sydney Halpern meticulously chronicles America's hepatitis program in her book, Dangerous Medicine. She's with us for the hour. Sydney, let's look at the prison population that the researchers enrolled. They told prisoners, and you write that their participation was a route to rehabilitation, that these prisoners, the issue wasn't consent. They were consenting. It was their involvement in this research what gained them early release. That is hard to fathom. That is bonkers. That is an very much an ethical red flag.
Yeah, it is. So the prisoners were never promised early release. The way it worked was what they were promised was at the end of their participation, they would be given a certificate of merit or letter of appreciation. And these letters, some of them were on official letterhead of the Army Epidemiology Board or Armed Forces Epidemiology Board. One researcher had his certificates of merit stamped with the seal of the university. And these were both given, a copy was given to the inmate and a copy was put in the inmate's file. And inmates understood that when they came up for parole or discussion of early release, that these certificates would be taken into account. There was also a lot of language about this is going to help you rehabilitate. So there was a rehabilitative ethos within the criminal justice community that wardens and administrators of prison systems, many of them subscribed to these ideas. The idea was that participating in a dangerous experiment by making a sacrifice for the common good, prisoners would be redeemed and returned to society. That was the narrative. And a lot of prisoners signed up.
One of the first deaths was Herman Lee Ford, who was 24 at the time, an African American from Detroit. He had signed a waiver, but it was challenged by Helen, his wife. What happened there, and what really unnerved scientists?
Yeah, so there were four deaths that I uncovered from hepatitis. That were basically the direct cause of the experiments. And they were all from fulminant hepatitis B, which is a rare condition, but it's almost always fatal. And Herman Lee Ford was the first. He was an inmate at a prison, was called in Michigan, called Jackson State Prison. And he was from Detroit, and he was incarcerated for 3 to 5 years for receipt of stolen goods. Now, the inmates did sign consent statements, but all of the consent statements included what was called a waiver provision. And this was a provision that said, basically, I waive all rights to sue in the case of injury or death, and I waive all rights for those around me and all my heirs. And Herman Lee signed one of these. In this case, his common law wife was told by the prison warden, well, you should ask the researchers for compensation. And what happened was she wrote a letter to the researcher, and the researchers became very alarmed and sent it to his to the Office of the Army Surgeon General, which oversaw the experiments. And they sent it to the legal division of the Defense Department, at that point, the Department of War. And they got a communication back saying, tell her to forward her marriage certificate. Now, everybody knew that they weren't formally married. So, and of course, she couldn't forward such a document. And so what they were saying to her was, and she had also asked for a copy of his consent form. And they were basically saying to her, you don't have legal standing on this issue. And it was a really sad story. It was, unfortunately, throughout these experiments, there were people who weren't 100% okay after the experiments. Some of them had other kinds of problems, longer-term disabilities. And after the war, particularly after the war, researchers started asking the Defense Department for the option of buying life or disability insurance for the human subjects. And they were turned down repeatedly by government lawyers, basically. And they were told, no, you get liability insurance and use that plus the waiver provisions, and that will protect you. So they weren't interested in protecting the human subjects. They were interested in protecting themselves and the researchers from legal suits.
Did they think that these waivers and consent forms that the subject signed, would they have held up in court?
Well, some people who were lawyers thought they would not hold up in court, but they certainly had a very, very strong impact of discouraging people from pursuing suits. And I think that was their major function. Because after all, the human subjects were people without resources. They didn't have money to hire a fancy lawyer. And it was the federal government. And it was the federal government during World War II at a time of war. And after the war, it was the federal government at a time of the Cold War. And these were justified as being necessary to protect soldiers from infectious disease and therefore augment the national security of the United States. So that was the kind of argument that the government was making at that time.
So the sentiment of the times that they were in and this huge power imbalance really took away any rights from the subjects they experimented on.
Yes. So the woman who identified herself as the common law wife, or she identified herself as the wife as Herman Ford, really didn't have any legal options. She couldn't even claim that she was legally his spouse. You know, I tried to find out if they had children, and I just couldn't find anything from available records. But yeah, she was really not treated well. She was treated very poorly.
We're talking with Sydney Halpern, who studies moral issues in medical research and practice, author of Dangerous Medicine, The Story Behind Human Experiments with Hepatitis. You can join in. What safeguards would you like the government to put in place when it comes to medical research? Have you helped conduct a clinical trial? What do you think that people should know about this research and how it is done today? 800-642-1234. The subjects who were in these consent forms, quote, volunteers, and there were quote marks around volunteers, were I believe, the children and the people who were institutionalized. Can you go into this class of people who had experiments conducted on them?
Yeah, this was the most heart-rendering stuff. There were about 300 mental patients who were used. They were mental patients in a mental hospital in Trenton. And the quotations, it was very interesting. Researchers routinely would be referring to their human subjects as volunteers, independently of what the circumstances were surrounding recruitment. Mental patients and people in institutions for developmental disabilities, clearly many of them didn't have options. Who knows what kind of consent there was, if they had any choice or not. For the children, there was consent from parents or guardians, but in some experiments, the guardians would have been the director of the institution. Hmm. The interesting thing about the quotations was that some of the people who were actually on the research team, so there were 10 research teams, and each team had a number of investigators. So there'd be a senior investigator who was always a very well-placed, prestigious researcher, but there were other people who were actually carrying out the experiments. And these were younger doctors. During World War II, they were doctors who were doing their service in the Army Medical Corps, and they were assigned to these experiments. Some of those doctors were barely older than some of the human subjects. But with the mental patients, the people on the research team that was doing these experiments, they would make a differentiation between the volunteers without quotation marks, and they were the conscientious objectors, and the volunteers with quotation marks, who were the mental patients. Mm. So it was like the research team even differentiated people who they thought were actually volunteering and the people who they didn't really think were volunteering. They're just going to call them that with quotation marks. So that was really, I thought, kind of eye-opening that, you know, and just an aside on that, there actually was a lot of pushback and resistance to these experiments throughout the 30 years. Much of it never became publicly visible. But there were researchers who said, you know, we shouldn't be doing this, or we shouldn't be using this category of people. And after the war, European medical societies came out with positions saying we shouldn't use captive people. We shouldn't use people who are prisoners and imprisoned in, you know, in a criminal justice system, because they don't have the option of really choosing.
The children who were experimented on, you know, specifically at Willowbrook State School that you talked about, in the archives, is there any indication that tells you what these children endured, what they experienced in this research, what they went through?
Well, there's very little about that in the archive. I did interview the mother of a child, a girl who was 10, who was admitted to Willowbrook in 1971. And so I got some insight from her. And this is another heart-wrenching story. Her daughter was born autistic, but very seriously autistic, never developed language, and she would engage in self-harming behavior when she was frustrated. And the mother was just overwhelmed. When the child, whose name was Nina, was 10, her mother Diana had two other children. Her husband worked nights, and she just couldn't handle by herself taking care of her 10-year-old. And so she sought a placement at Willowbrook, and they basically said, you know, we're overcrowded. The way to get in is through admission into the hepatitis unit. It won't be very long, and then she'll be put in a regular ward with children. And so Diana decided to do that. Mm. Diana and her husband, who was Nina's stepfather, would visit Nina on the weekends, and they saw that she had been drugged, I guess, to keep her, you know, relatively calm while in the ward. and she was kept isolated, but they didn't know any of the details. So that Diana was tremendously relieved that Nina left the ward without having contracted hepatitis B, and that would be, those were the experiments they were working on at that time.
I'm just going to pause right here. Northwestern University sociologist Sydney Helpern with us as we look at America's mid-century hepatitis program, and her book leads us to this very ethical question. What research abuses do we justify to ourselves in today's medical world? How do you regard these mid-century pediatricians who were renowned for their research, but also have this human experimentation as part of their legacy? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The hepatitis studies in mid-century America forces us to confront the question, what is the difference between innovative therapies and scientific experiments? What about consent when experimenting on vulnerable populations? Can risky human experiments ever be legitimized? Still time, 800-642-1234. Sydney Helpern's book is called Dangerous Medicine. She's with us for 9 more minutes. Let's bring on a caller now. Diane is joining us from Brooklyn. Hi, Diane. You're involved in drug development. Is that right?
Hi there. Yes, I've been in this business for about 40 years.
And what would you like to add?
So I really get what Sydney is saying, and it's very important. And I have done classes on informed consent and the Tuskegee subject. And I just really want to kind of level set here with the Declaration of Helsinki, with IRBs, institutional review boards, and ethics committees. People like myself who conduct these clinical trials are trained heavily in how to write informed consents. And we have physicians that look at risk benefit. And the reason I bring this up is because in this day and age, when people are so afraid to get a vaccine, I want to make sure we level set and people understand these things happen, but every time they happen, something better was put in place to prevent them. So I don't want to create people's fear. You know, the only way we develop new drugs is with subjects and with patients. And if we scare people off because they think we're doing unethical things, and I'm not saying Sydney's book says that at all. I just haven't heard the other side in this discussion. Mm. Just want to level set a little bit.
Diane, thank you so much. Really appreciate that comment. And you bring up something that is in your book, Sydney, is the Helsinki Declaration. Go ahead to Diane's point.
Absolutely. So at the end of this period of time where the hepatitis experiments were taking place, there were regulations instituted in the United States, which created institutional review boards. And also included regulations about restricting experiments with groups that are classified as vulnerable, and that includes children and includes prison inmates. So it's very, very definitely much harder to recruit these kinds of groups into non-therapeutic experiments. So that's absolutely true. And so I thank Diane for pointing that out. I do think we do need to be aware of who now is being recruited. And I would like if there were a lot more transparency about that, because for now, I think we're in a system where we're paying people instead of recruiting people who are, basically subjects of convenience. And I think that brings other kinds of questions up about most people who are participating in non-therapeutic experiments are people who basically are income insecure. I'm not talking about therapeutic ones. I'm talking about the ones in which an individual really has nothing to gain medically from the experiment. So I think there are different questions today that come up in the conduct of, say, drug development. But I absolutely agree. We need people to serve as subjects in experiments, and there's no doubt that there's scientific benefit from these kinds of experiments taking place.
Diane also brought out the Tuskegee study, the Tuskegee syphilis study. How does that fold into the history that you told in hepatitis?
the revelations about the Tuskegee experiments, which hit front page news in America in 1972, after going on for 40 years, were a turning point in public opinion and congressional action that precipitated the creation of regulations. It was kind of the final straw before Congress moved to create, to pass the National Research Act, which created a national commission that advised on restrictions on vulnerable groups. The Tuskegee study is very well known. It was very unethical. It was racialized in its assumptions. The more than 400 African-American men who had tertiary syphilis were told they get treatment. The public health researchers who did the study withheld treatment, basically deceived the men, and tried to create obstacles to their getting care for their treatment. Although I will say they didn't actually give the men syphilis, but it was highly unethical nonetheless. But it became a turning point. The revelations became a turning point in creating new regulations.
So, Sydney, what brought an ultimate end to the human hepatitis experiments in the early 70s?
There was really outcry over research abuses during this period, and there was pressure on elite researchers, both from outside of medicine and also from within, because the rights movements actually entered medicine itself. And what happened was that the research elite could no longer control the narrative about these experiments being in the best interest. The press started covering disputes among physicians and started asking questions about whether we needed new rules for human experiments. Also, there was outcry over the conditions at Willowbrook that basically shut the Willowbrook down as an institution. So that for the hepatitis experiments, the shutting down of Willowbrook was critical.
We only have a few seconds left, but it's not lost on me that your publisher is Yale University Press, and Yale is deeply complicit in this story of America's hepatitis program. And I'm just curious, how is that working with your publisher when they are at the heart of your book's tension?
You know, I haven't heard a peep on this subject. It hasn't come up, which is interesting in itself.
Yeah. What can we learn in this pandemic era as we try to race for the right COVID vaccine, an ultimate vaccine?
Well, I think we need to realize that the risks I'm talking about, again, I'll just repeat, the risks I'm talking about from hepatitis are from the disease, not from a vaccine. I think we've been very lucky with the hepatitis vaccines. With the COVID vaccines. I know there's a lot of perception that it happened really quickly, and it indeed did, but I just want to point out that work on the mRNA technology was going on for 50 years before this, and that vaccines had been created for other diseases that ended up not being as seriously pandemic. So the research community was ready to go on this technology. So it really actually, although it happened overnight, the work on it proceeded for decades.
Sydney, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Cindy Helpern is lecturer of medical education at Northwestern. The book is Dangerous Medicine on the Ideas Network.